Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. And again, the Illinois budget stalemate is the story, but this time with a difference, a big difference. After 2 years, it is over. The legislature completed its override of Governor Rauner's veto of a new spending plan. The budget story is one that has kept the then-Illinois Public Radio Statehouse Bureau Chief Amanda Vinicky busy over the last 24 months, and she has kept us abreast of developments along the way. Amanda is now correspondent for WTTW Television's Chicago Tonight, and she joins us by phone. Amanda, nice to have you with us.
It is my pleasure.
Did you think it would ever end?
Honestly, no. I mean, I never thought it would get to that point is really part of it. This is not how it's supposed to work at all. You've never seen a state government go through this for good reason. And I should say that that is at least as far back as we can tell. The National Council of State Legislatures has gone back to at least the Great Depression. So who knows if any state had an impasse of this magnitude prior to that point, but at least since it doesn't go like that because it's set up to have a government shutdown that never really came to fruition in Illinois. Instead, it was just little bits and pieces of, granted, for those bits and pieces in those small areas, some big time suffering. So when it had gone on that long, I think the expectation really was that due to politics, because this is, of course, Illinois, that plays a huge role in things, that it wouldn't be resolved until after the governor's race next year. So it truly was, to me, surprising that it got taken care of prior to that point.
What, and in very basic terms, what was the final deal?
So the final deal is the big headline, I think, because it, of course, hits people's own pocketbook and bank account, is a tax increase. It takes the personal income tax rate from 3.75% to 4.95%. And that really is an interesting number there. You may be wondering, 4.95, where did they come up with that? And that's because, this is cute, just under 5%. And that is the rate that it was back according to the 2011 temporary income tax rate that automatically rolled back and was not extended at the request of Governor Bruce Rauner, which truly sets the stage for this impasse and also the fiscal troubles that Illinois got into, because once this impasse started, the state was still spending at a rate that it had back when that higher tax was in place. Now you have, however, legislators, even those who voted for it, say, yeah, it went up, but not what it was. So that's why it's 4.95%. Also, you have the corporate income tax rate increase, and so that's an element of it. And then what that does is, of course, pays for a budget that is roughly $36 billion. According to Democrats, it is a balanced budget. But Republicans, many of them at least, say, hey, that in fact is not the case. And there's kind of some complicated reasons for that that we can get into if you'd like. But point being, it at least is getting Illinois closer to a balanced budget in that it cuts roughly $3 billion of spending. As I indicated, right now, in fact, Illinois is spending not only more than it has taken in the past couple of years, but even more than it had, because throughout this impasse, again, circling back to how there really wasn't a true shutdown, that's because you had a whole bunch of consent decrees and court orders, literally judges saying, Illinois, just because you don't have a budget, you can't stop doing basic things like paying for poor people's health care via Medicaid. You can't stop taking care of foster children that are wards of the state under DCFS. And so through those court orders, Illinois was spending, again, like it still had that higher tax rate in place. And so that is what now we have a budget where it goes less than that. It makes cuts of about $3 billion. Where that hits remains to truly be seen in terms of how it is felt. It basically is across the board 5% cuts to state agencies and bureaucracy, and then public universities and community colleges are seeing a trim of 10%. But then you do see increases elsewhere, particularly when it comes to early childhood and to education.
You know, this is a double-edged sword, I think, for reporters throughout this process. It's been a heck of a story. but a very complicated one, and because of its because it just was ongoing, and never seemed to stop. Tough on reporters to cover a story like that sometimes.
You know, I think the toughest part about it, there are a couple of things. And one is really getting across to people why this matters. Like I keep on saying, and this is because it is so important, I think, to for people to understand, people are saying, hey, I'm still paying my taxes. Where is that money going? And I haven't seen, for a lot of people, probably a true consequence of the budget impasse. People could still go to state parks. When you needed to get your driver's license or your license plate renewed, that was still up and running. Really, people seem to be most angry and noticing when the Secretary of State's office, this is what, about a year ago or so, was no longer able to afford to send by mail reminders that license plate annual sticker renewals needed to be done. And so people were upset about that and getting ticketed. And then when you've had both recently and one time prior, issues with the lottery. First, when the lottery wasn't able to actually pay people who'd won money, and then more recently, when the multi-state organizations that run the Powerball and Mega Millions dropped Illinois because they said, hey, we don't want to put up with you. If you can't afford to pay your winners, we're not going to go there. That ruins our brand. That was what perked people's ears up when truly, again, it seemed as if some people would say it was really designed by politicians to not impact most people. They could then win election, keep on riding like this, play out their political fight in Springfield, while it was only really universities, particularly poor students who depend on MAP grants that help them afford tuition, as well as if you were a social service organization or a state vendor, particularly maybe a doctor that it takes a lot of state employees who have insurance and they're years late paying those bills, or some of the social service agencies that have closed shop. I think a real notable one, for example, is in Jacksonville, which is outside of Springfield. It is one of the only places in a pretty large area because it's not very populated that people with drug addictions could go for treatment and help at a time when, of course, we have the opioid crisis and there is a need for that. There are oftentimes waiting lines. Instead, it shut down because it couldn't afford to pay its employees because the state wasn't paying it for services it was contracted to do from Illinois government. So, again, really portraying to people why this matters is one thing. Even the credit rating, people's, I think, eyes glaze over at the notion, credit rating, what does that mean and why should I care? And then the other complication is that, well, it is described as a budget impasse. Clearly, it was. But really, the budget was part of the collateral damage versus the heart of the issue itself. This was not a fight where for 2 years legislators were arguing back and forth about priorities of spending. Rather, there was a broader political fight between Democrats who control the General Assembly and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, and the budget was caught in the middle of it.
You know, Amanda, it's going to take a while, obviously, for even with the increased tax, for money to begin rolling in. There is still $15 billion in bills to pay in the state of Illinois. It seems like it's going to be a very slow process to get this ship back on, you know, an even keel.
Yeah, that is putting it mildly. There are those who already say that the tax isn't enough. One of those includes Governor Rauner himself. In part, that's because, as I was saying, this isn't really a budget fight. It was a broader one in which the governor said he would only agree to increased revenue if there were reforms that he believes will bring or keep more jobs here and grow the tax base instead of increasing the tax rate. And what Republicans and critics of this move say will chase people away. So there's that element. Will there need to be more? Will there need to be a service tax? Pensions continue to be a strain on state government. And while this does include some changes, you've already had a warning from Moody's, the credit rating agency, basically saying Democrats and Republicans didn't come to an overarching deal. We are still concerned. And bringing Illinois to junk bond status is very much still a possibility, despite the state finally having a budget in place and new revenue to help afford all of that spending. As to that backlog of bills, yeah, $15 billion is astronomical. And what's even worse about it is that for many of those bills, those that are for health care, so again, Medicaid, state employee insurance and such, when Illinois is late on them, it's paying an interest on it of 9 to 12%. So part of what this budget does is says there's a quote-unquote surplus spending that's not going to go to government services. That will be used to bond out money. So Illinois will try to, presumably, at hopefully a better rate, something that could be a problem if we are downgraded at all, but would be able to borrow money at a lower interest rate to pay back those bills and stop accruing that higher interest. Part of that could be reimbursed by the government, any of that Medicaid spending from the federal government. So the hope is that about $8 billion of that backlog can fairly quickly be dealt with. But there's, of course, still that other half that is outstanding and certainly an issue.
Did the governor get anything out of this deal?
Yeah, the governor gets to say that he had nothing to do with the tax increase, and in fact, he fought it as he's running for re-election. So, yeah, that's what he got, which is huge, truthfully, because this is going to be a very expensive, presumably very tough race. He also got, I think, a pretty stinging rebuke from the Republicans, 15 of whom voted, or 16 total, one in the Senate and 15 in the House, who broke ranks and defied him on the original bill. Five of those House Republicans did not support the veto override. So I think that is something that shows a break in ranks and gives people perhaps pause about his leadership style. Beyond that, these reforms that he's been clamoring for, of course, it depends on who you talk to. Democrats say that they went further than they had expected to go. There is, for example, a local government consolidation bill that passed out of both chambers of the General Assembly. That is one of Governor Rauner's priorities. But the governor says that that is fake. It doesn't do much. Basically, he says, very difficult for local governments to consolidate. One Republican characterized the quote-unquote reforms passed by Democrats, trying to give a nod to the turnaround agenda of Rauner's, as quote unquote lipstick, basically saying they're fake reforms made to look good. And so that is another of those outstanding issues. Democrats do say that they are going to continue to work with Republicans on Governor Rauner's wish list. But in a sense, you have, of course, now with a budget, that pressure taken off, with that threat of Moody's and a credit downgrade, as well as the election ahead. Maybe it even serves Democrats to get some cover, pass some of these measures, so they can say, yes, I raised your taxes, but I also did this. That very much remains to be seen.
Is it dead certain that the governor is going to seek re-election?
You know, he hasn't officially announced, which is kind of strange, but perhaps not when you think about it. I think a lot of people would have found it in poor taste, potentially, had the governor had some sort of big rally or truly started campaigning for a re-election when there was no budget, when there was all this suffering. So while he has not done that, he certainly has a very healthy campaign account. He has gotten donations, and previously in discussion with the Chicago Tribune editorial board did say that he planned to run again for office. There certainly aren't any other Republicans that are waiting in the wings that are seen as credible contenders against him.
Well, that's another one of those stories that remains to be seen. But I just wonder how much of what's gone on for the last 2 years, Amanda, is the result of his inexperience. I mean, he came in as a non-politician. I guess he is one now. But how much of this is...
He doesn't like to say that, but...
How much can be placed, blame can be placed on his inexperience as a politician?
Critics of the governor would say that there's a lot of it, both inexperience and also his attitude toward government. I mean, there are certainly differences between Bruce Rauner and Donald Trump, but critics of the governor, including one of the Democratic contenders, I just saw a mail piece sent by J.B. Pritzker, who also has a whole lot of money, that enough that commercials have been, been aired already through him and campaign ads trying to draw Trump and Rauner together, painting that image of an outsider politician who clearly is skeptical of government and doesn't have it may be an appreciation of it. And so I think that there's part of that. The Speaker Michael Madigan, the governor's nemesis in this, says that it was the governor trying to rule basically by intimidation and threats of, say, running a challenger against somebody who defied him, waving his money out as more of both a carrot and also very much a stick that led to this. And not really trying very hard to get to know legislators, not trying to compromise, that he was a CEO, wanted his way or nothing, and continually moved the goalposts. I should add, of course, that for every critic of the governor as an outsider, his lack of understanding of what government needs to do, should do, how to get it done in the art of compromise, there are those who say, good, they want the term limits that Governor Rauner has been asking for, and then they say, look at state government, look at what it has happened while you have had one Illinois House Speaker since 1983. For all but 2 years, Madigan has been in charge in the Illinois House. He's also chairman of the Democratic Party of Illinois, certainly wields a whole lot of power. And critics say, hey, look at the job, the fine job that has landed Illinois in. It's time for change, and it's time for somebody to try and run this more like a business.
All right. Well, Amanda Vinicky, I want to thank you so much for the last couple of years that you've helped us on this particular story. But, of course, your assistance to St. Louis Public Radio goes back beyond that. I hope you're enjoying your new life for WTTN, Chicago Tonight in Chicago. But thank you so much for being with us, Amanda. It's nice talking to you again.
Thank you, Don. It was great talking to you and all the St. Louis Public Radio listeners.
Thank you. Coming up, political reporter Joe Manis. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. We're joined for a few minutes now by Joe Manis, our political reporter here at St. Louis Public Radio. Joe, thanks for coming in.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things. I listened to your piece this morning on Governor Greitens, and one of the things that struck me was how much he is sounding like Donald Trump. He's talking about fake news. He's talking about the liberal media and disparaging terms. Do we have Trump light down there in Jefferson City?
Well, to be fair to Governor Greitens, I mean, Governor Greitens does have gravitas, and but in this particular case with his videos, that's aimed at the base. That's aimed at the Republican base, and
Trump.
Yeah, well, the Republican base in Missouri. Various Republicans have told me that the internal polling that they have still show Trump, at least among the base, in plus territory. Mm-hmm. And that statewide, he's still like 50 or more. I mean, this is granted, I haven't seen the polls, and I don't always, but internal polling often is pretty accurate because the politicians and the parties do those to get a sense of where they need to drive their message. So from that standpoint, I mean, I think he feels that this is a way to, A, appeal to the base. And his base, he isn't appealing just to the base in Missouri. I mean, by all accounts, Governor Greitens has broader ambitions at some point. And he's already pretty close to the Vice President, Mike Pence. So, and he has been out there and praising Trump. So I think this is part of that. Now, I mean, he has... Greitens has a sense of humor. I mean, because frankly, one of the problems with the videos, if anybody ever watches them, is that they need a little better production quality. So there's this massive echo. So actually, I tweeted something about, regardless of the content, he needs to do something about the echo chamber, and his staff got a big kick out of that. So my point is, he does have a little lightness about it. I mean, he's not like... And he made a point yesterday. I was at the press conference that he had yesterday on police, the police blue alert, but he brought this up. We brought him up and asked him about this. He made a point of saying that his videos did not attack any local or regional media. It was just the national outlets, because he said at least the local people, he said, even if they're wrong, they try. Of course, you know, there may be disagreements whether or not we're wrong, but at least, you know, he had kind of a sense of humor about it.
You've watched him throughout the campaign.
Yes.
Obviously. Is this the same guy as governor who ran for governor?
Well, in some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. I think one of the intriguing things yesterday, we were talking about the fact he never wears a tie. He hardly ever wears a tie. His uniform, so to speak, is jeans, white shirt, always stiffly pressed, mm-hmm. starched, and a blue blazer. And when he was at an event a few weeks ago with the Wisconsin governor, Scott Walker, Walker had on the same uniform. And in fact, if you're in a crowd like I was yesterday, you could spot the governor's staffers, because every one of them, male or female, had the same uniform on, except the press guy didn't have the blazer on. And he was joking that he was kind of going rogue because he didn't have the blazer. So from that standpoint, that is the guy who ran. Now, some of the conservative positions he's taken and some of the things he's pushed have surprised some people. I mean, he's much more focused on some of the key conservative things, on like the abortion front, labor, some of the other things that, while he talked about it during the campaign, they were not his biggest things. His biggest things during the campaign was economic and his mantra, if you want different, do different, which he still says all the time.
Yeah, the abortion thing is very much on his mind, obviously.
Yeah, but see, he made a point yesterday. And in fact, my colleague Jason Rosenbaum had done a story on this a week ago, before he did the video before all this, where the governor's office and now the governor was trying to make clear that his attack against the St. Louis provisions, anti-discrimination provisions, which have to do with protecting women from being fired or discriminated against by landlords or employers if they've had an abortion, use birth control, or are pregnant. He made a point yesterday of saying, look, my whole message with the General Assembly is I want them to protect the pregnancy care centers. It's not some of this other stuff. It's not like going against contraception. And he said, that's what the national people are making it sound like, and that's not what I'm doing. But on the other hand, I mean, he has said publicly, although he didn't say yesterday, he did want some more stricter abortion restrictions because of the federal judge decision a couple months ago, which tossed some existing restrictions out. So in some ways, you could say he's trying to play both sides a little bit. Now, he's not the first governor in either party who's done that. So I'm not, you know, I mean, he's not, as I said, he's a sharp political guy. He sees what's going on. So he's trying to calm some tempers at the same time, still appeal to his base.
Is he pretty much on board with Jay Ashcroft's willingness to go along with this whole voter information thing that Washington and the Trump administration wants?
Yes. In fact, I asked him. And he did say that as long as it's public information that's being given out, which he says, he points out rightly, if that's public information that if anybody applies under the Sunshine Law to get, he said, if they can get it, then why shouldn't the White House get that? Now, I talked to Jay Ashcroft at length yesterday about this, the same place. But Ashcroft has emphasized that, okay, it's address, it's your name. It is your birth date, because your birth date is public record in Missouri, not your Social Security number. That is not. And the state keeps no records. There are no records on how you voted, and there's no record from primary voting of which party ballot you take, because in Missouri, there is no registration for voting by party. Now, other states, including Illinois, it's a little different. But in Missouri, that's one of the things that it's been that way for decades. And in fact, the national parties don't like that. So from that standpoint, there's really no way, there's no records for them to give on that. Now, what Ashcroft was contending yesterday was that the White House may be able to provide him and other Secretary of States with data on, they want to make sure there's no illegal immigrants who have somehow managed to vote or register. I've got the ACLU and some of the others are already saying that's not the issue. But in fact, because Missouri has a lot less illegal immigration than many other states for various reasons that have nothing to do with this. So, but he was defending his position but saying that his whole point is he wants to see an examination of vote fraud, and if there's not there, then let's move on.
Just a couple of seconds left. Has there been any kind of a political backlash in Missouri against that at all?
I think so. I think that's one of the reasons that Ashcroft was talking about it. His office has admitted they've been getting peppered with calls from people who are concerned about what sort of information mm-hmm. is being given. And this spans party lines. Look, I mean, there's a majority of the states are either refusing to provide the information or being very careful on what they give.
Right. That's what we've been hearing. I think 44 states have gone on record in one form or another, but I've got to end it there, Joe.
Okay.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Always a pleasure. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.